Labor Industries bills today, and we may as well just get right going here. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2254.
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2254 imposes a 45-day timeline for an employer to provide copies or allow the inspection of personnel records to an employee upon the employee's request. It does allow a time extension upon the agreement for the employer and employee if their records are not easily accessible. And then the bill also establishes a civil penalty of up to $1,000 for violations.
All righty then. Thank you. I have Dan Gardner and Steve Lanny. You want to just come on up to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and thank you for having a hearing today on House Bill 2254. This legislation will provide a remedy for a statutory right where none exists today. Currently, ORS 652.750 provides that employees have a right to request or to see or obtain a copy of their personnel records, which have been used by an employer to determine the employee's qualifications for employment, promotion, additional compensation, employment termination, and other disciplinary actions. However, the law does not specify how long the employer has to respond to an action. This bill, if it's passed, would require an employer to respond within a designated time frame, 45 days, which actually should be sufficient even if the employer is out-of-state based. It also allows for an extension if the employer and employee mutually agree to that extension of time period to view the personnel files or get a copy. It also provides for a civil penalty if the employer fails to. Besides being an employee right, it's frequently helpful for an employee and their representatives to view the employee's personnel file. It often assists the employee in understanding why the employer has taken certain employment-related actions and what, if any, documents support that action. And if the employer fails to comply with the law and provide the employee with access to the employee's record, only viable option now is for the employee to seek administrative recourse or hire an attorney and seek a court to order to compel production of the required records. Because many employees are unable to afford legal action and enforce this law, there's currently no meaningful way to enforce this right. Currently, if Boley receives a complaint about a possible violation, the personnel records law, a letter is sent to the employer informing the employer of the requirements of the law. Boley sent 117 such letters to employers during the last two fiscal years. To the extent the employers subsequently complied with the law as a result of receiving these letters is not known, since the agency currently informs employees that their only other recourse if the employer fails to comply after receiving the agency letter is to pursue action in court or hire an attorney to request the records. Yet, as I noted earlier, there is no remedy if the employer fails to respond to the letter. If this bill is enacted, Boley would undertake a serious educational and technical assistance effort to inform employers in the community of the requirements of the law. After that educational campaign, the agency anticipates compliance would be very high. Thank you for your consideration. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I only have Steve on. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Lanning. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We're in support of House Bill 2254, and we think it's a good idea and that the amount of time that it would provide is a reasonable amount of time, and that there is flexibility so the employer and the employee can mutually agree to extend that time as well. And unfortunately, something like this we think is needed in some cases. Thank you.
Okay, any questions for Representative Holweek, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Gardner, I was curious, in the bill, the employer may charge an employee for getting these documents only an amount that is reasonably calculated to recover the actual cost of providing the services, it says. Do we have anything in statute or I guess anything by rule that really establishes what any reasonable is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holdy, I'll let Christine Hammond, the head of the Wage and Hour Division, answer that.
My name is Christine Hammond. I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division. And there are some guidelines, actually, in BOLI's own rules about what reasonable charges are, because we provide copies of records upon request. And there are some guidelines in model rules of procedure put out by the Attorney General's office in terms of what constitutes reasonable charges. And it has to be the actual cost to the employer for providing the records. So you can charge for an a staff person's time to make copies and photocopy the actual per-page photocopy fees, etc. So there are some guidelines that are available for determining what those reasonable charges are.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holdy, however, there are only those guidelines. There's nothing actually in statute. To answer your question about the statute, there is no specific cost within statute of how much per page or what level an employee can do the copying. And sometimes I have heard of us getting complaints when not only somebody copied it, but also an upper management person reviewed it, and sometimes those charges can be rather high.
Follow up?
Yes, sir.
I guess that gets at my question. I've also heard that it may be possible for employers to charge attorney fees for having attorneys review documents that they are handing out to employees or the public in some cases. So are those reasonable charges to have attorneys review these documents before they're handed over?
Chair Schaffler and Representative Holby, under the model rules of procedure that the Attorney General's office puts out, it is permissible to pass along charges for review by attorneys if there's a question about whether or not the records are disclosable under the public records law. Now, I'm not sure that would apply to this law. I wouldn't think that providing anything in an employee's personnel file would be exempt from disclosure since it relates to that individual employee. So I personally can't think of a situation in which it would be necessary for an attorney to review records in an employee's own personnel file before the employer provided those records. Does that answer your question?
Follow up, Mr.
Yes.
Chair? Just one more, and I'll let this go at this point. But wouldn't it be up to the employer to decide whether or not attorney fees would be warranted in any kind of review of their documents? I mean, it wouldn't be up to your agency or anybody else's. It would be up to the employer whether or not they're going to put attorney fees in there.
You're probably right about that, but I don't think that would be a reasonable charge for an employer to pass on to the employee. But you're correct that the bill doesn't address that one way or the other.
Thank you.
Any other questions for these nice folks? All righty then. Thank you very much. Is anybody else interested in testifying on House Bill 2254? All righty then. And I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2254 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2255. And I have the same nice folks again. Mr. Lenny, you want to come on up? I have one nice person after that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, again, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and with me is my legal policy advisor, Marcia Olemiller. House Bill 2254, this bill would clarify the employer.
Dan, we're 2255, right?
I'm 2255.
Just make sure I'm right.
You were right. That was a slip of the tongue. 2255. This bill would clarify the employer's responsibility and the employee's rights when an employee exercises his or her wage and hour related rights. Currently, the law provides a whistleblower type remedy for certain kinds of retaliation. If there happens to be a criminal penalty associated with the right that the employee asserts, indeed there are criminal penalties still on the books for many wage and hour related violations. This includes an employer failing to give an employee required meal and rest periods or failing to pay minimum wage or overtime. Unfortunately, the current law is quite convoluted and needs to be clarified so employers and employees know and appreciate their rights and responsibility. The key points of this legislation are to align the law and process relating to retaliation against an employee from inserting specific wage and hour-related rights by making it an unlawful employment practice similar to a whistleblower-type remedy already provided in ORS Chapter 659A. It also clarifies the compensatory damages deemed a remedy, for an individual who is fired or is subject to adverse employment action, such as a demotion, discrimination against a protected class, etc., for asserting wage-related rights, filing a wage claim, or reporting violations of working conditions, minimum wage, or overtime laws. It makes it consistent with the compensatory damages remedy currently available for all criminal whistleblowing-type behaviors. In the current law, the Civil Rights Division of the Bureau enforces current whistleblower-type laws in the Civil Rights section of the Oregon Revised Statutes. This whistleblower protection covers someone who has reported criminal activities, has cooperated with law enforcement, or has initiated or testified at a civil proceeding or criminal trial. As noted, many wage and hour related laws provided for criminal sanctions, if they're violated, they're predominantly misdemeanor sanctions under ORS 652-990 or 653-991. Thus, reporting or complaining about a wage and hour issue contains a statute with criminal sanctions would already be covered under 659A-230. Even contacting the Bureau of Labor and Industries or any administrative agency or the employee reasonably believes has jurisdiction over wage and hour law concerning any wage and hour retaliation right is considered initiating a civil rights proceeding, and it currently falls under the protection of 659A-230. To give you an example, an employee contacts the agency or inquires about the law governing meals and rest periods because she believes that her employer may be violating law. Although she has not filed a formal bully complaint, she may not be retaliated against for making such a bureau inquiry under the current law. Basically, if you review the chart that's attached, it does allow for more standardizing of the practice, processes, and remedies. And House Bill 2255 proposes to clarify and standardize those remedies and make them consistent with those that are currently offered to those who are whistleblowers under 659A-230, notably the judicial remedy under 659A. Currently allows recovery of compensatory damages of $200 or actual damages, whichever is greater, and the punitive damage, as well as attorney's fees.
Dan, just so you know, we didn't get a chart. So
you didn't get a chart.
That's okay. I'm sure we will.
We will find the chart.
All right. Very good.
We actually created one. I've seen
confident
it.
You
I believe it exists.
Very good.
But we'll get that to you, Mr. Chair. But actually, what it does is really does a lot of clarification, aligning and realigning a law to make it clear both to employers and to employees what those protections are. And thank you for your consideration. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions on this bill? All righty then.
Oh, excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Oh, Dan, we're going to keep going down the panel. Yes, Representative.
Yeah. I did want to ask a question, Commissioner. Does this bill take away any rights that employees currently have?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I'm glad you asked that question. This is in absolutely no way intended to take away any rights that any employee currently has under any protection under the law. It's just a realignment of those protections to make it clear.
Thank you.
Ma'am, do you have testimony, or are you just here to help the Commissioner today?
I'm here to respond
okay.
to questions if needed.
Very good. Steve, go ahead.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Lanning. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We're in support of House Bill 2255, and like the Commissioner said, we believe that it would clarify the employer's responsibilities and the employee's rights and make the remedies more standard. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? All righty then. Thanks a lot. I'd like to call up Lisa Trussell, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Are the mics where they're supposed to be?
I think so.
Okay. I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and I didn't check the box on the sheet on whether I was for or against, but what I had wanted to present to the committee was a suggestion on page 2 of the bill on line 31, and that would be to either eliminate compensatory damages or put a cap on them for that line. And I would ask for your consideration of that proposal.
All right. Well, thank you. And just talk to the commissioner, and I don't know if you want to do there, and we'll be having another hearing. And
well, we just met with our committee yesterday, so I haven't had a chance yet
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative.
It would seem from the language of this bill, though, that it says compensatory damages or $200, whichever is greater.
And if that's the case, then that would be the cap. But yesterday at the meeting I had with my HR folks, they thought it was the greater of, and so that's why they thought that it could exceed the 200. So.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Well, I see.
Oh, yeah, I get it.
It's whichever is greater, so it's about 200. You get more than 200.
Yeah. Right. Anyway, thank you.
Great, thank you very much. Any more questions of Ms. Trussell while we have her here?
I'll be back.
Alrighty then. Well, thank you very much. Would anyone else like to testify on House Bill 2255? Yes, sir. Come on up.
Chair Schaffler and members of the committee, my name is Michael Dale. I am the executive director of the Northwest Workers' Justice Project, a firm that represents low-wage, nonprofit firm that represents low-wage workers in matters of employment law. Under existing law, there is no limit or cap on the amount of damages that are recoverable, and I rise to oppose the suggestion just made that some cap be put on them. Quite frequently, when someone loses their job because they complained about wages, the effects on people's lives can be extraordinarily catastrophic, and it goes beyond the loss of the wages they would have otherwise earned. It goes to sometimes significant trauma from being unable to find reemployment. Frankly, blacklisting is a function here. If your prior employer isn't giving you a good recommendation, it can be very difficult. That can cause all kinds of problems at home. I think it's entirely inappropriate to limit the amount of compensatory damages that would be available and urge the committee not to adopt that suggestion.
All right. Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Dale? All righty then. Thanks a lot. Unless anyone else, there's no one else on House Bill 2255. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2255 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2256. And Mr. Gardner and Mr. Martinez, I think there's room up here for you. Dan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, again, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. House Bill 2256, in essence, speaks to electronic paychecks. This is a modern thing that's happening in larger firms. Actually, today, most state labor laws and regulations are silent to this issue or unclear about the use of electronic paychecks as a legal payroll delivery device. The Federal Reserve Bank recently estimated that more than 2.2 million workers nationwide have chosen to receive their pay via electronic pay cards, more than doubling the amount of pay cards that are circulated in 2003.
To date, a handful of states, about nine of them, have taken up and passed legislation regulating this action to permit the use of these pay cards. Other states, such as New Jersey and New York, have recently proposed legislation concerning the use of the pay cards. This bill just clarifies state law to clearly state that when an employer and employee agree to authorize the employer to pay the employee's wages electronically, the employee must be able to use the device without a fee or discount on at least one occasion at a bank or other establishment, place of business, in the county where each card is used. And this bill aspires to modernize the payment of wages by making more convenient and flexible methods available to employers. In fact, electronic banking has become more common. Numerous employers have approached the Bureau to inquire whether they could legally pay their employees through such electronic payment devices. Bottom line is, if you're paid by paycheck today, you can go to the employer's bank of origin and cash it to the very last cent. And we're just attempting to clarify in state law that with electronic pay implements, you can do the same thing one time to see that you get every cent of your paycheck. When in developing this bill last session, the Bureau worked collectively with the Department of Administrative Services, payroll companies, employer representatives in the House Business and Labor Committee. Senate Bill 141, as it was last time passed through the Senate, won the support of Associated Oregon Industries and the Farm Bureau last session as well. We're just really trying to see that each employee gets every last cent of their paycheck one time going to that bank.
All right, then. Mr. Martinez, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. And the commissioner is absolutely correct. This is a new technology that we're trying to make sure is allowed under statute. There obviously is some some confusion whether it is or isn't, and I point that out because, for example, the state of Oregon has entered into a contract with one of my members and is actually now paying some state employees using this technology, so it is in use. I also have other members that are dealing with private employers and using this technology. So we're all in favor of clarifying the statute to make sure that everybody, including the state, is following the law. As the commissioner mentioned, and I commend him and thank him for working with us last session, Senate Bill 141, we agreed would get out of the Senate and get over here to the House so we could continue that discussion and keep it alive. We are still trying to find the right words for the statute that makes sense and will allow this to occur. What I am instructed by my folks to say is we are very close. I think we can and will get this done this time around, and we would like the opportunity to bring in some of those banks that are offering this service and make sure that we're all working off the same page.
Yep. Currently, my check from the state is deposited electronically into my account. Now, I'm not as diligent as my wife is, so I don't know if every penny of my paycheck accessible right now. Like if I get paid $1,000 from Oregon on the first of the month, can I go get $1,000 out, or is there currently a fee taken out by the state or the bank or whoever? Do you guys know the answer to that?
Well, Mr. Chair, currently what you're doing is you've chosen through the state to have it deposited uh-huh. to your bank,
right?
And you would get every single penny out, although your bank can certainly charge you a service fee
right.
monthly for the use of your account.
Right. Yeah. That
what we're talking about in this particular situation, more often than not, is where the employer uses a single bank of their choice and issues you a pay card that's paid every single pay period, which may not be your bank
right.
of choice, it's theirs.
Okay.
And I would just add, Mr. Chairman, if I could, that, you know, currently, if you look at the state of Oregon, in talking to the state treasury, about 80% of state employees currently
get their pay the same way you do, through electronic deposit, direct deposit. So there's not a lot of folks that are using this within the state, but there are some that are indeed doing that. We would like to see, in addition, in this bill, some reference to some of the consumer protections that are already out there, so that if I do, as an employee, go down this road, I know exactly what my protections are. We think that's important as well. We have had conversations with the nurserymen and others that really see this as a great way to pay folks that aren't necessarily banking in any specific Oregon institution.
Mm-hmm. Any questions? Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, just a clarification. What I hear is that the bill as written won't get us there and amendments are on the way. Is that what, or is the bill?
Representative, I think we're going to have a work group, and since it's such a fun bunch of guys, I was going to sign myself to it.
Okay.
So I think
that's
what we're going to do.
We volunteer you, sir.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to work with you on it. I just hope we can get this done in a very short time frame.
Yeah, I think we can figure it out. We have so many smart people on this work group. So I think we can figure it out. Any other questions? All righty, then. Thank you very much. Thank you. Would anyone else like to testify on House Bill 2256 today? All righty, then. Then I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2256 and open a hearing on House Bill 2258. Have I been forgetting for you to want to?
It's up to you, Mr. Chair.
We have a commissioner right
we
here.
Do. You
Let's
do.
Dan, just go right ahead.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee.
Your job.
Sorry, I've been neglecting my administrator here.
Glad to help you both out. It's no problem.
Labor commissioner stole your job.
Thank you. Thank you much for holding a public hearing on House Bill 2258. This bill, if passed, would, as amended, would require employees to correct payroll errors and underpayments of 3% or greater of the gross pay due within 24 hours. Errors and underpayments are less than 3% due would have to be corrected no later than the next regular scheduled payday. Current law doesn't really specifically address this situation other than the provisions of ORS 652.120, which requires the employer establish, maintain regular paydays at which date employees are to be paid the wages due and owed to them. There are no specific provisions for how some errors must be corrected and underpayments paid to the employee. BOLI does anticipate either wage claims or claimants regarding underpayments of wages. However, there are no penalties for violations of this law, and the employees would not be entitled to a penalty wage unless or until they terminate their employment and are not timely paid all the wages that they are due. Current law, ORS 652.125, provides the authority for BOLI to require an employer to post a bond when it is determined that the employer is failing to pay wages within 5 days of a payday scheduled by the employer. However, we generally have used this statute for situations in which the employers are missing paydays rather than making errors or mistakes made. The Bureau has received several complaints from workers regarding the failure of employers to correct errors and underpayments of wages in a timely manner. In particular, the Bureau was contacted in last year by several nurses who complained of such a situation repeatedly occurring in a Portland area hospital. It is possible that the agency may experience a slight increase in the number of complaints that are investigated. However, the agency does not anticipate the increase would be significant enough to warrant a request for any increasing of staff or funds. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any of your questions.
Any questions of the Commissioner? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gardner, I used to own a printing company, and I hired a payroll company to do my payroll. And checks would come out on Friday afternoon, and I'll be honest with you, that's why I hired a payroll company. And under this provision, if I happened to be busy on Friday afternoon and checks were issued, and on Saturday morning somebody called and said, you underpaid me, then I would have the rest of Saturday to get back and make sure that those people got their check. Am I understanding this bill correctly?
The intention of the bill is to 24 hours of notification during the workday when there are people at the business. It may not be clear in the bill that that was the intention, but I wouldn't intend for a company to have to pay them on Saturday when you would not be open for business nor have any payroll personnel there.
So you would consider an amendment that, Paul, exactly. That would... I see this 24-hour thing as a sinkhole for small businesses with small payrolls who, as mine were, who basically within 24 hours suddenly you've got this coming. So I guess I think 24 hours, while I know you're looking at the poor person who didn't get enough money, I also heard you testifying that there's a few big offenders out there, and this is a big fix for a sort of offender-specific problem that I think would have a pretty fast effect on small businesses in their payroll. So I would look to something that gives either more than 24 hours or something that talks about work days and banking days, because that's the other issue. Just saying Saturday, you know, my printing company had a retail part that was open on Saturday, but I wasn't necessarily there. And I can tell you my payroll manager wasn't there because he worked a regular work week. So I see the potential here for something that's a little very small business unfriendly, and I'd like to see some work. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, we actually, from the final pay period, exclude Saturdays and Sundays from that. We only count Monday through Friday under our current administrative rules. And the intention is Monday through Friday within a 24-hour period. Some of the situations, you know, to give you an example of what was brought to us was actually where the employee had filled out the payroll cards right, they'd have filled out reimbursements right, they literally didn't get more than about 35% to 50% of their pay and were expected to wait two more weeks till the next regular pay period to get the remainder of their paycheck. And when an employee has car payments, house payments, insurance payments, etc., the intention of the bill is not when there's a $20 error, you know, to cause an undue hardship to pay that. But when it's a significant portion of the employee's paycheck that they need to keep their family going, then they need to. The intention also is not to include Saturdays or Sundays, but make it Monday through Friday within 24 hours.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you for that clarification. But I also notice it's 3% or greater, and that's not 30%. That's 3%. That could easily be a clerical error. And I would just ask that you look into these things, and maybe we could talk to some of the small business advocates about how to make this a little more workable. I appreciate it. And I appreciate your indulgence,
my
Mr. Chair.
My pleasure, Representative.
I don't want to...
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger. I'd only say that to a minimum wage worker, 3% is a significant portion. So it depends on where you're at. So.
And just for your... one out of seven is a pretty significant number, too. So if we could work with the representative on
absolutely.
That, I'd appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think you clarify that with a business day, because the definition of a business day is anything other than a weekend and or a holiday. I think I'd clarify the whole thing. My other question, Mr. Chair, is what about if the employee turns in their time and they make an error?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, first of all, your suggestion of an amendment would be a very welcome amendment. I'd be happy to make that correction to make it clear that it does not include holidays or weekends. Secondly, if the employee makes an error, I mean, to be honest with you, the role and responsibility under current law is with the employer to keep time correct. Well, the intent of this is to get at employers' errors and omissions. So payroll needs to be into, you know, to the employer by a certain period of time in order for them to make it, whatever their pay period is established and set up at. What type of employee error would you be addressing?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Example, back in the old days when we used to have veneer plants and sawmills, I used to run those, and we had to take care of our payroll in a little book. And you would ask someone to work over 2 hours or a weekend, and maybe you weren't there, and they would check their payroll, but they would forget that they worked a Saturday. Bam, you have a problem. Now, most everyone in the 21st century uses time cards today. I understand that. But we did not at the time, and probably things have changed in the last 30 years, I hope. But that's exactly how we did it, and we'd make some errors. It wasn't necessarily our error management, but the employee themselves had made an error when they were checking their time.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, I mean, as you point out, times have changed, and most places do use time cards today, although I do remember the time frame you're speaking of.
A little bit.
I go back that far, too. The thing is that it is the employer's responsibility to make sure time cards are correct and to keep hours. If we were to, you know, try to legally delineate between what's the employer and the employee's responsibility on this and to try and distinguish between the two, it gets the Bureau, when we get to an investigative standpoint, of a finger-pointing, you know, it was their fault, and it's really hard to get to the bottom of that. What we'd really try to do is encourage employers, when there's an error, no matter whose fault it is, to get that check out to them as quickly as possible. And I'd also say, from the standpoint of the wage and hour division, the way we go about enforcement, even on meals and rest periods or anything else, our goal is to get the employer into compliance. It's not to go out and fine them first time for everything. I would never encourage anyone to do that, and I'd probably take corrective action against my own employees if I caught them doing that. Our goal is to educate the employers to what the law is through our Technical Assistance for Employers Unit, and to make sure that employers know what their rights and responsibilities are, and if an error is made, get it corrected. We would never consider fining someone until they've made two or three errors in a year or two period of exactly the same offense.
Any other questions for? If you're making minimum wage, you make roughly, let's say, $300 a week, and that's 1%. 3% is what, $9? I kind of share the representative concern about a 3%. How did we get to that number? And $9 if you're making minimum wage, I understand. That's some gas. That's some lunch money. God knows what it represents. But how did we get to that number?
Well, Mr. Chair, to be honest with you, we came up with this bill a few months ago. I can't remember how we came up with that number, but I'm not opposed to changing it upwards a little bit. But again, my concern is really not looking at the high-end paid person on the scale.
I understand.
They wouldn't be affected by that much. It's the low-end person and how much of a difference that would make. So, you know, if we were to make it 5%, I'd have no problem. You start getting up into the 20%, and that's pretty significant.
That's a lot of fuel. Believe me, I understand. Yes, Representative.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, I just read the book, and just read the bill, and it does not specify the percentage. Mm-hmm. It just says, and it actually doesn't. The 24 days is left blank, and it would be easy to put business days in there. So that 3%, I suppose, is the record or something. But I concur with your evaluation. I don't know what's magic about 3%, but I do know for $9 to call my payroll people on a Saturday or even the day after a holiday and say there was a $9 mistake on somebody's minimum wage, mm-hmm. 2 week, and yes, $9 is not peanuts, and it is owed, but I think we're getting to the point of you have clearly articulated, Commissioner Gardner, some cases where there are egregious examples of employers taking advantage here. And those are the people we want to go after. I'm just worried that we're getting into minutia that is going to affect all employers and just cause problems rather than attacking the real root of the problem, which are specific employers who are doing this on a regular basis over some substantial amounts of money. That's my point, and we can work on this. I'm sure we'll get there.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Berg, I just want to clarify that we have an amendment in that would add the 3%. I should have clarified that in my testimony, and there is a blank in there, and the amendment also would say 24 hours. And, you know, we're workable on the percentage. We're workable on making sure that we don't include holidays and weekends. And, you know, just want to make sure that people get
the money they're due so they can pay their bills.
Thank you. And I agree absolutely and completely, and I'm confident we can get something done. Any other questions? All righty, then. Thank you very much. I'm going to need the DS here for a minute. A bunch of people who want to talk about this one. I'd like Steve Lanning, Debbie Silva, and Martin Taylor, please. Well, Debbie, you want to go ahead?
Sure. Hi. I'm supposed to say hello to the chair first and to all of you. I haven't testified before, so I may not know the appropriate way to present this. I do not have written testimony. I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Debbie, just identify yourself for the record, please.
I'm Debbie Silva, S-I-L-V-A. I work for Oregon Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals. I'm a labor representative with them for the past 6 years. We represent about 2,300 RNs and healthcare professionals with Kaiser Permanente and Providence Milwaukee Hospital. I'm here to speak in favor of this. I wanted to tell you a short but quick story. I heard your concern about the employer's ability to pay people quickly when there's an error. And although I understand in those situations where it's a small business, it might be a problem, I'm here to talk about employers who have the time and money to pay timely when errors are made, but yet have no incentive to do that. In this case, I'm talking about a large employer like Providence Milwaukee Hospital. As you know, the Providence system does have enough money to pay their registered nurses and healthcare professionals. Yet, last year, in 2005, I was preparing to negotiate a contract with the employer and began to discover from RNs that they had major problems with their paychecks. And when we presented this to the employer, they did not feel that they needed to put any special effort into correcting these errors. The errors would get compounded over several paychecks. Once an error was made and not corrected in the next payroll period, then a second error was made. Then the next payroll period, they would correct the first error but not the second error. And it would compound until I was unable to even untangle this web of errors. I had workshops for the RNs to have them come in and help them understand how to audit their paychecks and how to figure out what was owed. We asked the employer to do audits. They refused to do that. We had RNs who had errors in their payroll as high as $800. Most of them were more around $100 to $200, some as little as $40. But at some point, the RNs were in a situation where they could not at any point figure out how to get the monies owed to them because they couldn't figure out how to tell the employer what they were owed. We made our own payroll error report form. We had one manager in the OB department finally decide to look at one payroll period and found that out of 20 employees in her department, 14 employees had incorrect paychecks. So I think there are situations where an employer is just not willing or interested in making the payroll correct. This is a large employer with their own payroll department, and they have the ability to train the payroll people to do this correctly. And although we think this is the modern day and age, for this hospital, the RNs would fax over their timesheets to a payroll department. And they had supervisors who were supposed to check those before they were faxed over. But what we found is that most of the errors were not the RN and were not the supervisor. It was the payroll department who failed to understand things like standby pay, overtime pay, jury duty pay, holiday pay, et cetera, and would just get it wrong consistently over a period of time. I would also say that with a union, although we're in a position to help them and correct that and spend time to do that, I'm concerned also about unorganized employees, particularly in this hospital, who have no one to protect and support them at all and who may never get paid correctly, and who I heard just have given up. So I hope you can help them, help us to put some protections in here so that the employers might be a little more persuaded to make corrections when there are big flaws like this. Thank you.
Thank you. Martin? Oh, excuse me. Well, we'll do the whole panel here, and then we'll ask questions. Martin, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Chair Schaffler. For the record, my name is Martin Taylor. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association. I appreciate the commissioner bringing this legislation forward. I know part of the initiation of this bill came from a collection of nurses at a variety of hospitals. I introduced a letter to you for the record from Juanita Wolf, a nurse who's affiliated with ONA, who would like to have been able to come and testify herself today. Was unable to do it, and has left me the dubious distinction of trying to explain something complicated. She could explain it to you better, because she actually had to navigate how to get a correction to her own paycheck over a period of time. We, as ONA, assisted her in that. I think if she hadn't had ONA's assistance, there would have been a tendency to want to give up on the situation, because it is frustrating and complicated. It has been resolved now. In her case, her employer for a while denied that they were making an error, so we had to go and do the research to conclude that, in fact, an error had taken place. And that is certainly a complication in this bill. It's not just a question of error. It's a question of dispute as to whether or not an error has occurred. So I think in the dispute process, it would have been unlikely that they would have been resolved had they not been represented by the Oregon Nurses Association in this case. That's certainly not a problem unique to nurses or hospitals. I feel badly like somehow we're making this look like a nurse issue. This is an employee-employer issue regardless of setting, but we happen to be the poster child. So I brought you Juanita's letter. A couple passages in it I thought were very telling. At one point she talks about so many of the nurses called nursing payroll department that they eventually agreed a mistake had been made. Polling that you got a mistake is not exactly a scientific method, but, you know, goes to how pervasive the problem was. And she also says that nurses at another facility in the same system are continuing to lose pay while they're waiting for this to be addressed, which tells us that even as you correct it in one place in the system, until there's that critical mass, you still have the problem someplace else in the system, and they're all in the same system. I guess I would conclude by saying ONA supports this legislation. I certainly understand the dialogue you're having. I don't have any real strong suggestions about amendments. I think you should get the bill right, but I think that this is something that should get addressed. It is a real absence in our law that a dispute can take place, can be protracted. People who are depending on their income can go without that income even though it's due to them, and there's no part of the law that creates urgency on the part of the employer to correct it. On the part of the employee, there's an urgency. They still have their bills to pay. And what you're really doing is a bill to create some urgency to solve the problem rather than leaving people in a position where they're wondering how to pay their bills or being put in a position where they just give up because it's too frustrating.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Lanning. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO, and you've heard from our two union affiliates that it is a problem. We support the concept in House Bill 2258, whether it's 24 hours or one working day or 3% or another number, whatever works would be fine with us. But from what we've heard, we think that something like this is necessary to correct the problem. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don't want to, you know, backtrack too much, you know, but any discussion of the 3%, you know, and I recognize that $9 isn't a lot of money, but being a former minimum wage worker at $1.80, you know, I think that, you know, 5%, you know, I'm thinking about that. Well, that's $15. You know, the fact is that money belongs to the worker at that point, and, you know, frankly, they deserve to get it. So I caution the committee and all involved from raising that percentage too damn high, because, you know, that money belongs to the worker at that point. So thank you.
I don't think you'll get any argument but from me about not about raising it too high, Representative. Yes, Representative.
Mr. Chair, but you'll get an argument out of me just because I'm feeling argumentative about this. I am still concerned that the solution doesn't fit the problem. What you have, the bill talks about errors, okay? What you're talking about is a dispute over what is owed. And they're two very different things. And I'm really concerned that you're capturing this error notion when what you really want to do is create a process whereby disputed things has some resolution and then goes through a process where they finally decide how this is computed. And I don't see that in this bill. I see words in this bill about a little error. This is not a little error. This is a dispute over what is owed, and I'm just not comfortable with this bill as written as a process for getting to that. Thank you, because Representative Holby is going to come right back, and Mr. Chair is going to run out of patience, so I'm going to shut up.
Oh, I'm patient. I am patient as an oyster, Representative. Any other questions? Representative Holby.
Thanks. Just one last comment. You know, I respect where you're going with that, and I agree. You know, there is a difference, but, you know, at the end of the day, whether it's an error or an omission or something that's on purpose or accident, the fact is the money still belongs to the person that worked for it.
Well,
and I think they ought to get their money in a timely fashion.
I think everyone agrees with that. Would you all like to respond to those nice comments? Yes, ma'am.
In the examples I was giving, it's not a dispute over what is owed. In fact, we came up with our own form. We gave it to the employer. They did not dispute that our calculations were incorrect. They weren't saying you're not owed overtime or you're not owed jury duty pay. They just simply had a payroll department that consistently over time could not figure out how to pay them correctly. The form that the RNs fill out, their timesheet that was faxed over, was correct. But the payroll department could not calculate correctly because they could not understand their own payroll system. So these were not, we don't think you're owed those wages. We don't believe you deserve jury duty pay. Where it's not that. It's that they just couldn't figure out, because they're a large employer, so it's not the small employer. They're a large employer with many hospitals, and the rules are slightly different for some of those hospitals, and their payroll department couldn't get the rules right, so they would just pay them incorrectly. Mm. And so I just wanted to clarify that. If it were just a dispute about your owed overtime, we would be filing a grievance under our contract, and we would be able to prevail that way. But this is a different situation that's not grievable.
Mr. Taylor, you do.
Yeah, similar comment, but just as a, it also hooks into this 3%. In the case of some of these nurses, what you really had was a situation where they were working hours that should have had a higher rate of pay, overtime hours. And that was bargained. And in order to get there, they had a strenuous process of gives and takes at the bargaining table. They weren't being paid the differential for their overtime. So that is, to some extent, the same to the nurse as saying, maybe it's only 3%, but the fact of the matter is, it's not just 3%. It's the hours I worked overtime. It's the hours away from my kid. It's the hours I worked tired. I'm supposed to get paid more for that. It represents more than the salary of what they can buy. It represents the fact that to get that, they had to struggle, and to give that time to the employer, they had to have the employer agree that that time was worth more, because it was a period of time that they were giving beyond a regular shift.
Yeah, when I joined the union, they handed me an hour book. And they told me, and I did, I still got it stashed somewhere, mm-hmm. Keep those hours religiously. And then it wasn't just how many hours. It was, did you work through break? Did you work through lunch? Mm-hmm. Was it overtime? Was it time and a half, double time, holiday? Was it on a different work site with a different prevailing wage? There were a whole list of things that, and to be honest with you, I was young and single. I didn't pay much attention to it. I cashed my check on Friday. But you're right. It does make a difference. It makes a huge difference because those folks earn that money, and they're current contractually owed that money. And by God, every employer in Oregon should be getting it right.
And if Juanita were here, the last thing she'd say is that after it was all resolved, it still took 6 weeks to get her the back pay because they had to recalculate it. And right. In her mind, after going through that entire process of finally getting them to recognize that they had been miscalculating her paycheck, the dispute was whether or not it was correctly calculated, that she then had to wait 6 weeks to get it right. And she kind of felt like, hey, at that point, well, as soon as you admitted that you'd made the problem, it would have been nice to have had a resolution more quickly than 6 weeks.
I appreciate that. Any other questions or comments for this panel today? All right, then. Thank you very much. Oh, Commissioner, please come and respond if you'd like.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just want to clarify one thing. This bill only addresses errors and omissions, which are those that the employer and the employee agree are underpaid or inappropriately calculated. There's an entirely separate process and separate statute for those where is a dispute between the two parties whether they are not being paid the right rate of pay or not. So this strictly is with those where they are in total agreement. That is wrong. It just hasn't been paid yet.
and I was involved in one of those where we didn't agree. But we got our money. Alrighty then. Thank you. I'd like to call Mike Green, Lisa Tressel, and Jessica Adamson, please. Mike, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Green. I'm the Associate Vice Chancellor for Finance and Administration and Controller for the Oregon University System. I'm here today to talk to you about HB 2258. While the Oregon University System fully supports the intent of this bill, we clearly want to pay our employees what they're owed on a timely manner. We are concerned about the 24-hour turnaround requirement in the bill. In order for us to continue to administer an efficient payroll system, we would propose a 72-hour time turnaround time. As very brief background, on any given payday, system campuses pay approximately 26,000 employees, so we're not unfamiliar with the complexities of the process or the importance of accuracy and timeliness. The concern with the 24-hour time turnaround requirement is primarily one of efficiencies. Currently, system campuses run supplemental payroll processes, which is what is required in the event of an underpayment, in a batch mode, which is more efficient. At a minimum, these processes are currently run twice a week. Requiring a 24-hour turnaround on these payments would require that campuses run those processes more frequently with fewer payments, making the process less efficient. Furthermore, and perhaps more compelling, is that requiring a 24-hour turnaround would effectively eliminate our ability to make these payments electronically. It requires 72 hours to meet the time constraints on file transmission and processing to the State Treasury and the Federal Reserve. Not being able to utilize the electronic payment process may, in fact, mean a delay in those funds becoming available to the employee due to time in transit with mailing and taking it to the bank, if we're forced to cut a paper check. In the event that an employee has a hardship whereby a 72-hour turnaround would not suffice, each OUS campus has in place payroll draw procedures that could be used in those cases that are more easily processed than as a supplemental payroll check. We brought our concerns to the attention of Boley and would appreciate an opportunity to continue to work with the commissioner to find a mutually amenable resolution. Thank you.
All right. Lisa?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lisa Tressel with Associated Oregon Industries. Wanted to appreciate the clarification from Commissioner Gardner on the disputed versus undisputed. And listening to the proponents of the bill today, I don't disagree that there needs to be a fix, but I share Representative Berger's concern about employers with the payroll systems or even as mentioned here with the university system, that 24 hours may not be a reasonable amount of time to correct the problem, and would suggest as a possibility there's got to be somewhere between 24 hours and the 6 weeks that the example mentioned before. And if it was a weekly payroll, that it could be paid on the next regularly scheduled payday. And if it's something more than a longer stretch of time between paychecks, then work out an option for an earlier payment then. But I'm not sure that people can get it turned around in 24 hours. I'm not sure it's a reasonable time frame. Thanks.
Thank you. Jessica?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. And we, too, appreciate the clarification on disputed versus not disputed, because our employers, when they pay prevailing wage, there are honest disputes all the time about whether you've got the correct classification over the last 2 weeks or not. And going through those records and coming to an agreement sometimes is a lengthy period of time, and sometimes the employee's in error and sometimes the contractor's in error, but trying to get to that in 24 hours would be very difficult. So we appreciate that clarification, and we would ask that perhaps be made a little clearer in this legislation or a reference somehow, so that there's no confusion on the part of the employer that if we're talking about something that's undisputed as opposed to something else that is disputed, we're only dealing with the undisputed issues. And I would also echo, even when we are talking undisputed, that for some of our small employers, trying to get to that in 24 hours would be really, really tough. And that in construction, sometimes work days aren't just during the week. It is also a business day for them on the weekends during the summer and in other times. So looking towards something that gives a little more time, again, understanding that if you have an agreement, you need to get that money in the employee's hands as soon as possible, but also looking for those small employers to mitigate what is a difficult process for them as well.
Thank you. Any questions? Well, everyone in this room agrees we need to do something. So let's all put our heads together and do something. Do we need to do another work group, or can we just all work on this?
Mr. Chair, I think if I get a couple of cards here from the university system, we can just come back with something to you.
And will you all put all your input, the employer folks and the employee folks? I want to hear everyone's input, too. Because I think we can all get the yes on this. I'm confident we can. And that's what I want to see happen. All righty, then. Thank you very much. I'm going to, unless there's anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 2258, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2258 and open the hearing on House Bill 2259.
That'd be my cue, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I guess so. I got my job back. House Bill 2259 increases the current time frame in which an employee may file a retaliation complaint under occupational safety and health laws from 30 to 90 days. It establishes that when a public records request has been made in regards to the complainant, neither the written complaint from the employee or the employee's representative or representatives or a memorandum containing the identity of the complainant may be disclosed under current public records statute. The bill declares an emergency, and you have in front of you, committee members, a -1 amendment from the Bureau that extends the time period from 90 days to 180 days.
All right, Dan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, again, my name is Dan Gardner, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and with me is Amy Clare, the head of the Civil Rights Division of the Bureau. House Bill 2259 is a rather simple, straightforward bill. Current law says that you have 30 days after being discriminated against for an OSHA retaliation claim to file a claim with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. In all other forms of civil rights law, you have 1 year to make that claim. Simply what this bill does is extends that time frame from 30 days to 180 days, which is half that of all other civil rights laws. We've worked with the Oregon OSHA on this amendment, and rather than give you a long and lengthy explanation, I'd rather hear your questions.
Any questions for the commissioner or his able assistant, Representative Esco?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, do we have a lot of this in the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, am I pronouncing that correctly?
That's close.
Okay. I'll get it. For the record, my name is Amy Clare, and I'm the administrator of the Civil Rights Division at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We get quite a few of these complaints. We have a contract with Oregon OSHA to investigate claims where a complainant has made an allegation that the workplace is unsafe. They either contact OSHA or another agency or even actually just object in the workplace and they're overheard, and then they feel that they've been retaliated against, and they have 30 days after they have known about the harm or after the harm occurs to file a claim with us. Frequently, they don't get to us in time because they're not aware of the statutory deadlines, and it creates a lot of hardship. Some of the cases, the fact situations present themselves as such that we can take them under whistleblowing, but it's rather a stretch. And whistleblowing represents about 16% of our caseload at the Bureau, and we get about 2,000 to 2,500 claims a year. And then for OSHA claims where they actually meet the 30 days, we anywhere from 160 to 200 claims a year.
Representative Berger, please.
Yes, thank you for that explanation. I had a similar question. If they didn't know about it, so they didn't get to you in 30 days, what is magic about 180 that they will know about it and will get to you?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, it's just the thing is that when you've been retaliated in law, oftentimes you're reeling from the experience. You don't know what's happened to you. You're trying to come to grips with it. By the time you know you have a protection in the law and you know where to make the claim to, your 30 days may well have evaporated.
What 180 days addresses is that in all other civil rights protection, you have 1 year from the last time you were harmed in order to file a claim with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We picked a halfway mark for that for workers, for OSHA retaliation claims and said 180 days. And to be honest with you, what we also found is that in even though these claims only go to 30 days, we have to do most of the investigation anyway to see if they do fall within the time frame or not. So there's really no fiscal impact to us as well because we do most of the investigation whether they fall within that time frame or not.
Yes.
Yeah, I really preferred the 90-day. I agree that 30 days is pretty short. It seems to me if people are mad and the wounds are fresh and they need to act then where your investigation can actually get at information in a little more timely fashion. And I kind of like your 90-day original, but you switched it to 180, and I think you explained it was half of a year, and that's why you arbitrarily came up with 180. Thank you.
Any other? Oh, Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to reinforce what was said earlier, that it can be very confusing for people that they have to go to one agency to actually file a complaint to begin with, OSHA, because it's a safety issue. And then if something happens to them as a result, they have to figure out they can't file a complaint there. They have to go to this other agency. So there have been a lot of suggestions through the years about ways to change this process. But I think this is a pretty minimal change to just allow them to have adequate time to figure out where they need to go and what they need to do about it. And I would support it.
Thank you. Sure. Representative Esquel.
Yes. Question. When they go to OSHA, does OSHA lay out their rights in case of this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, for the record again, my name is Amy Clare with the Civil Rights Division. Yes, OSHA does have a process outlined in statute. I'm not the expert on the OSHA part of it, but there's also a requirement under state law that there's a poster that outlines the protections under the OSHA. The Oregon Safe Employment Act, and it also has a reference on the poster about your right to file with BOLI. Some employers forget or don't place it in a real visible place, so some employees are not aware of that right. And actually, in those instances, we're able to extend the filing, but that's really rare.
But I guess what I'm asking is, I know nothing about this. I go and I have a chain and a sprocket that's improperly guarded, so I go to OSHA and say, hey, they won't fix this. I've asked them on several occasions. They will not do that. At that point, does OSHA tell me what my rights are in case I get a retaliation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, yes, I do. I believe they do. I think, again, Amy Clare, I think that they would be better to answer what their processes are, but there's a confidentiality clause. I mean, if the complainant goes to OSHA and requests that it be confidential, that is kept confidential, and they also apprise them that they cannot be retaliated against for having made that claim.
Any further questions? Where's that poster in this building? I've never seen it.
In your office.
Well, there should in generally, Mr. Chair, in the lunchrooms, there are, you will find them particularly like in the cafeteria and their break room and whatnot. There's an 8-in-1 poster, and the favorite thing I love to tell people is if you're in business and you get those little notices from poster companies in November and December that ask you to spend that 40, 60, 80, 100 bucks, you can download those same posters online from the Bureau of Labor and Industries for free. And if you really want to spend the big bucks and have the 8-in-1 laminated one, we sell them for 10 bucks.
Good. My wife has hers in the staff bathroom. I've seen them there. Alrighty then. Well, thank you very much. If there's no further questions for this good panel, I'm going to call, Michael Wood and Steve Lanning, please. Mr. Wood, you may have some comments on what the conversation, maybe add some light to all this.
Thank you,
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Wood. I'm the administrator of Oregon OSHA, and I am anticipating that there are probably some questions I can answer. I have provided written testimony. In short, it indicates that we support the legislation. We were comfortable with the 90 days. We are comfortable with the 180 days. The reason we support it is that the ability for employees to believe that they can not only file complaints if necessary, but also talk to our inspectors at the time that we're doing an investigation or an inspection is really a critical component of our enforcement model, as it is of any enforcement model. And so we do support the increase in the filing period in order to make that more effective. I'll try to I guess anticipate the questions, and if I miss, I'm sure you'll refresh my memory. When we're dealing with complainants, we do advise them on every occasion in any written material that we send them that they have the right to file a complaint, and in fact we give them the information that they need to file that with the Bureau of Labor and Industries in the event that they believe that they've been discriminated against or retaliated against. We advise individuals of that orally when we're intaking complaints, and we do attempt to advise individuals of that during the course of worksite inspections. I think it's in that latter category that the advice we provide is probably most tenuous. That's not followed up with written correspondence with them because they aren't the complainant of record, and we're in the context where we're trying to gather information from them. They're frequently in the context where they're talking to a government employee, and in spite of our best efforts, they're a little nervous. I'm not sure they're always real clear when we're advising them of the protections that they have. It is certainly the case, although it does not happen frequently, but it is certainly the case where we run across situations where employees come to us, and as we are perhaps closing an inspection, which may itself take well over 30 days, they will tell us as we're wrapping some issues up about something that happened early in the inspection that they believe represented discrimination. You know, the last time you were here, I talked to you, and you should have seen the assignments I got from the boss the next day. Now, that's an allegation. It's not a finding, but it's the sort of allegation that represents a potential complaint. If too much time has passed at that point, then the employee can be in a situation where they can't ask the Bureau of Labor and Industries to consider the allegations and to make a finding on the complaint. 30 days is a very short time frame, and that is why we support the increase. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you, and I would welcome any additional questions, and I can answer them.
Well, Steve, why don't you go ahead first?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Steve Lanning with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We support this bill. We supported it last session as well. We think 180 days is a good compromise from the all the other civil rights protections that have 1 year. And if it needs to be modified one way or another slightly, that would be all right as well, as long as it gets dealt with. 30 days is way too short. Thanks.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative, please.
Mr. Wood, if you would, in your description, you do tell these folks that they have 30 days. I mean, in the training that you offer on these issues.
Chair Schaffler, Representative Berger, yes, it is our expectation of our inspectors that in the course of conducting all those interviews, they will advise employees of the fact that they have a right to be protected. I cannot guarantee that happens in every case, and as I said, it's not in any case the primary focus of the conversation, and I think there are many cases where people simply aren't paying attention. In that context, there's no follow-up, there's no written correspondence, so unlike our dealings with complainants, they don't get the plain, bold language that we do when we're dealing with the folks who file formal complaints.
One other follow-up, Mr. Wood. When you go to investigate these complaints, and I don't want to make too much of this, it just seems to me that in investigating something that happened in a workplace 6 months previous, you're going to have a lot of personnel changes, you're going to have a lot of things that make it a little more difficult to get to what exactly happened. And I'm not even going to ask you to answer that because it probably is going to put you in the bind. But I would just like to say, Mr. Chair, that the 90 days seems fine to me and 180 seems too much.
Any other questions? All righty then. Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I'd like to call J.L. Wilson and Lisa Trussell again, please. JL.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, JL Wilson representing NFIB, the Small Business Association here in Oregon. We, as you might imagine, we do not support House Bill 2259. The intent of 2259, obviously, to increase the opportunity to file retaliation complaints, and I don't think it's a stretch to say that more complaints will result as a result of the increased timeline, especially as it pertains to the 180-day amendment. And I think if you're going to subject a business to more complaints that would follow as a result of this bill, I think that there should be some compelling evidence to suggest that people are being unfairly precluded from filing these claims under the 30-day deadline. And I'm not sure that there is compelling evidence other than just a philosophical point that 30 days is too short. But I would submit to you that certainly 180 days is too long. And to be quite honest, even 90 days gives me heartburn. But I'll wrap it up with that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries. And when I was coming in to testify on the bill, it was on a 90-day bill as opposed to the 180. So I was going to say we oppose the 90 days, but with 180, the 90's looking better. But one of the things I listened to, and I think that JL hit on the valid points, you know, if it's going to be something involving litigation, you want it to come sooner as opposed to later, because then the later it goes, memories change, personnel change. So one of the things I was listening to was during Mr. Wood's presentation was that, you know, we're not certain that everybody who comes in during an inspection is told. So it dawned on me this is an education issue. And the Department of Business and Consumer Services has a lot of materials that they create and prepare for different consumers or injured workers are the ones I'm familiar with workers' comp. And it seems like it would be relatively easy to create a document for the inspectors to hand out to the workers they're interviewing when they're doing an on-site inspection, that in case they forget at the time that they're talking to them, that would remind them that if you feel you've been discriminated against for talking to us, you've got a remedy in 30 days to apply as opposed to extending the timeline. Thank you.
Well, I just want to say that if I was going to complain about something about an employer, the sooner I did it would be the better. Mm-hmm. I want, so it's really in the advantage of the employee to do it earlier. So extending the timeline, I don't think it really helps the employer or the complainer, the employee or the complainer. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, I'm kind of at a loss here. But any questions? Representative Rosenberg.
Mr.
Rosenbaum. Reading history at night.
Mr. Chair, I guess the thing that nobody has really addressed, though, is why should the timeline be shorter for this type of complaint than it is for other kinds of complaints? I mean, when people have other discrimination complaints, they have even longer than this. So what's the argument that it should be so much shorter?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I'm not sure historically why it was set at 30 days, but I agree. I haven't seen anything today to indicate that it's a critical issue that needs to be extended. And whenever you extend the timeline on litigation, you're inviting more litigation. And I think that there's times when litigation is appropriate, but oftentimes the sooner you get to the problem, the sooner it can be resolved, because the longer it goes, people's memories fade and participants have changed. But I can't tell you why it was 30 days to begin with. I don't know that.
Hmm. Any other questions? Representative Edwards.
Thank you. This isn't a question as much as speaking to Representative Rosenbaum's question that she posed, and it's been my experience that the longer, and I will go on the record as saying I think 30 days is too short. I have some concerns with 6 months. The longer you stretch it out, when people come into financially difficult times, I've found that people's memories about what happened and how they were aggrieved months and months past kind of start to get creative, and that's a concern that I have, and I think that's a very real concern. I think 30 days is too short, but 6 months, and I do respect, though, Representative Rosenbaum's question, why do we have different lengths of time for different things. But so that's an issue that I wanted to bring up, is that creative memories on the part of employees that may or may not have been aggrieved.
Any other? Representative Holy.
Oh, thanks. I just wanted to mention that creativity exists on all parts of the world. So,
thank the Lord in heaven.
But, you know, the 30-day issue, I mean, I think that's way too short, because I'm sort of confused why we have OSHA and one DCBS over here and, you know, BOLI over here, different agencies administering or enforcing the same statutes. I mean, just that would take me 30 days to figure out. So, I think that 30 days is too short.
Any other comments, questions, responses to any comments up here? All right, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Anyone else like to testify on House Bill 2259? All right, I'm going to close the hearing on that bill and open a hearing on House Bill 2260. And I'm going to... Teresa, please.
Yeah, certainly. House Bill 2260 allows compensatory and punitive damages and other relief for unlawful employment practices based upon race, religion, color, sex, national origin, marital status, or age.
Thank you. Dan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I believe this bill will forever be known as the one that actually has the chart.
Mm-hmm.
House Bill 2260, this bill proposes to align the remedies available for employment discrimination based on an employee's protected class, marital status, or age with those that are already available in similar types of discrimination. Employment discrimination based on an employee's protected class is equally as abhorrent as the other types of discrimination. The law should reflect this fact and allow for the recovery of similar damages. Current law allows the court to award injunctive or equitable relief, but not compensatory damages. Oregon law already provides that the compensatory damage for those who are victims of discrimination in real estate transactions based upon a protected class and those who are discriminated against based upon a disability or for exercising their workers' compensation right. There are 24 laws that relate to discrimination, and if you see the chart that's attached to our testimony, the chart shows the remedies that are currently available to individuals who file a lawsuit and prove that they have suffered a particular type of discrimination under ORS 659. Specifies the remedies an individual may seek. Currently, law only allows a judge to award an individual who has suffered discrimination based upon a protected class equitable and injunctive relief. Notably, state law provides a broader array of remedies to victims of other very similar types of discrimination, including the recovery of $200 in compensatory damages or actual damages, whatever is greater. This bill would enable those who suffer employment discrimination based on a protected class to recover $200 or actual compensatory damages. It would also allow the recovery of punitive damages if the employee can meet the test required by law to plead these damages. Federal civil rights law already allows for recovery for certain amounts of compensatory damages for protected class discrimination under Title VII. Compensatory damages are defined as such as will compensate the injured party for the injury sustained. It's proven these damages may include but are not limited to actual damages of loss of wages, mental suffering damages. Federal law applies to employees with 15 or more employees. State civil rights laws apply to employers with one or more. While the agency may experience a slight increase in the number of complaints filed and investigation, we do not anticipate the increase to be significant or any significant fiscal impact with the passage of House Bill 2260.
Thank you. Any questions for the commissioner? I just want to ask one question, and I asked the same question in this committee last session. There are some communities, Commissioner, that have ordinances that make sexuality a protected
class, and you cannot, will not, shall not, may not discriminate against someone based on their sexuality. In the state of Oregon, if you're a worker and you do not live in one of those communities, can you be fired based on your sexuality?
Mr. Chair, there are about 12 municipalities that we, through contract, enforce their gender diversity ordinances. In those areas that do not have those gender diversity ordinances, yes, you may be fired for, you know, for exactly as you describe, or for being perceived to be.
Yeah, and that's just flat out wrong. Anyway, I just wanted to make that comment. Any more questions for the commissioner while we have him here on this issue, on this bill? All right, thank you. Lisa Trussell, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify on House Bill 2260. AOI's Employment Practices Committee met yesterday to discuss this group of bills and determined that they were opposed to 2260. And the reason was, if you look on the chart that they provided you, as you can see on the chart, that's the one area where the state of Oregon doesn't currently have compensatory or punitive damages. But it's my understanding, and I think that that was what was indicated in Commissioner Gardner's testimony, is that for employers with 15 or more employees, you can get those damages if you file a federal claim. And I understand that you don't have to go to federal court to file a federal claim. You could file it in a local circuit court. So I guess I'm taking a long way to make a short point, but the point would be that for all the employers in Oregon that currently have over 15, that's something that they're, 15 employees, that's something they're already subject to through federal remedies. So this would increase the number of employers, particularly the small employers, who would now be subject to that remedy, which currently under Oregon law or federal law that they're not subjected to. And the next thing I wanted to say is, if you have a lot of questions, I'm happy to try to answer them, but I suspect you might have another hearing, and at that time I could get somebody who might be a little bit more versed on the ins and outs of the different remedies.
Just for every, we'll be having another public hearing on all these bills with a possible work session scheduled on the same day, and we'll get the appropriate notification out there. Are there any questions for Ms. Trussell on this bill? All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. The hour is late. I'm sure we... Okay. Like I said, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2260, and we'll be bringing all these back again for another public hearing. And I would say you can bet there will be a work session on every single one. So. Anything else for the order? Good of the order. With that, then, we are adjourned.